So this is John Kerr with a research shooter who's from Columbia University, and Harry Crowe, who just moved to UConn. So to motivate my talk, why are we interested in quantum computing? Very general question, and I think the basic answer is that quantum computing provides speed up for some specific problems. So we know some problems for which quantum computers would be better than classical computers. These problems, I'll just give a few examples: factoring, discrete logarithms, simulation of quantum mechanics. Of course, you probably all know this. Now, the big question is that, of course, there's a very important class of problems in complexity theory: NP-complete problems. So what about NP-complete problems? Can we solve them more efficiently on a quantum computer? Of course, it would be a huge result. So a typical example is 3SAT, but as you know, there's a large family of equivalent NP-complete problems, and they are all very interesting, and they have a lot of applications. So can we solve NP-complete problems more efficiently on a classical computer, on a quantum computer? This will be the goal of my talk, to answer this question. So if you read the news a few years ago, like a couple of years ago, you may have read many articles claiming that quantum computers are more efficient at solving NP-complete problems. This followed an announcement of a so-called commercial quantum computing, quantum computer. And you could read things like, first commercial quantum computer solves Sudoku puzzles. By the way, Sudoku puzzles are instances of an exact cover, which is an NP-complete problem. And you could read things like, quantum computer promised to reduce dramatically the time needed to solve a range of mathematical problems, known as NP-complete problems. Or quantum technology is particularly adept at tackling what are known in mathematics as NP-complete problems, and so on and so on and so on. So what's the deal? So some articles then raise this question. Did D-Wave systems achieve the incredible, a startling advance in computing that would radically expand human capacities for industrial activity and scientific discovery long before experts believed it possible? So before getting too excited, probably you're not so excited, I don't know, but let's take a step backwards and then try to see how quantum computers could actually solve NP-complete problems. The approach followed by D-Wave is to use adiabatic quantum optimization. So let's see how it works. By the way, if you actually look at the claims of researchers from D-Wave, they never say explicitly they can solve NP-complete problems efficiently. They are very careful, and probably they don't really believe it to be true. But on the other hand, if you look at all these articles, that's what they say. So obviously, there's something that has to be verified here. So
that's a good question. I will not answer this. Yes,
I think he has claimed.
I don't think so, actually. If you really look at what he says,
he never says, he says, oh, you can solve NP-complete problems. He will say that. He will not say it, it efficiently, but I think he left the ambiguity open. And I think
that probably he doesn't believe it, but still, he shouldn't say it explicitly because it would be bad for him. So anyway, that's another debate, of course.
So adiabatic quantum optimization, of course, is based on adiabatic evolution. So in case one of you don't know how it works, it's very simple. So you have a system with a Hamiltonian, time-dependent Hamiltonian, and you start with your system in the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And then the basic principle is that the Hamiltonian is really slowly time dependent. So it really slowly changes. And if it's really slow, then the system will stay close to the ground state of the Hamiltonian. So this is the basic idea behind adiabatic quantum optimization. And the obvious question, of course, is how slow should you go? Because if you go too fast, there's some probability of excitation. So the probability of excitation depends on basically two parameters. The most important parameters are the total time. Of course, if you go slower, it's better. And the gap between the ground state and the minimum and the first excited state. Of course, the larger this gap is, the harder it will be to get excited. And so it's going to be better. So Basically, the basic condition, without going into details, is that the total time is much larger than the inverse of some power of the gap. So this k is a constant, and there was some debate because the Falk adiabatic theorem stated by physicists for like 50 years, actually it's now known that it's not always correct, and so this Falk adiabatic theorem has k equals 2, and now we can have rigorous proof with k equals 3. But essentially it's not a problem because we are just looking at, it's just a polynomial inverse of the gap, so that's the point.
Got the picture. So in quantum mechanics, the energy gap that you have here, you interpret as a time, and obviously to convert between time and energy, you use h bar. The picture is classical.
Yes.
So what sets the conversion there?
I'm sorry.
Well, so I mean, if you had a classical system as drawn,
yeah,
you're supposed to have the intuition that you have some similar effect, right?
Well, you have different energy levels in this case. They are quantified.
In the classical system, obviously, it's not discretized that way, right? So, but
no, I know. It's just a classical picture. Maybe I should have written. Something like just a regular one.
So my question was just about the classical picture. There should be something similar. But what sets the conversion between the two?
Also, you're asking what would be the adiabatic classical theorem.
Yeah, roughly.
That's a good question, actually. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Because you would get excited anyway if you don't know. If you don't go exponentially, if you don't go like infinitely slowly, you will always get some excitation because you have very close levels. So I think there's some kind of, you can quantify how excited you get, depending.
Sure, but
it's
okay.
I use this picture because I think that people who know quantum mechanics, they will understand, and people who don't know quantum mechanics, they will understand better with this picture. That's basically
it. It was the height of the bomb to go to the next.
Yeah, true. But how does that relate to the time scale? That's what I was wondering. I don't know, okay. It's not, obviously not important for the talk.
No, should not. Hopefully. So this is adiabatic evolution. This is basically the adiabatic condition. And now how can we use this to perform, to solve an optimization problem? So this is the idea that the group of Eddie Fari at MIT proposed around 2000. So suppose you have a problem which is to find the minimum of some function. So what you do is you start with a physical system with some initial Hamiltonian for which you know the ground state. And then you will slowly change Hamiltonian to the Hamiltonian, to some Hamiltonian matching the function. That's, of course, hand-waving intuitively what you do. We explain more in detail for anti-compute problems what it means. But you change this Hamiltonian very slowly. And so if your evolution is very slow, you will stay close to the ground state, and then you can just measure the system at the end, and you get the minimum of your function. That's the very big picture about adiabatic quantum optimization. So now the obvious question is, how powerful is it? How powerful is adiabatic quantum computing? First good news, so let's start with the good news. First good news, it's quantum. At least it's not classical. So the first witness that this is quantum is that you can solve the Grover problem in time. There's a square root missing. Obviously. So you can solve the Grover problem in order square root of n, which, of course, is a witness that this is quantum, procedure, a quantum algorithm. And actually, probably better than it's just quantum, it's universal for quantum computing. So you can take any quantum circuit algorithm and turn it into an adiabatic quantum algorithm with only a polynomial slowdown. So this is, of course, very nice. So this means that we can just study this, we can just use this model instead of the standard model, and we will not lose anything. No, that's very nice, but I told you I would talk about NP-complete problems. So what can we say about NP-complete problems? Well, actually, it was the original motivation for adiabatic quantum computing. The first algorithm was an algorithm to solve NP-complete problems. It was this adiabatic quantum optimization algorithm. So the thing is that since we couldn't evaluate the gap
explicitly for very large problem, like analytically, people relied on numerical simulations. And the first numerical simulations were very promising. So here's a graph of the numerical simulations performed by the MIT group around 2000. And they showed that the growth was only like quadratic. It's very nice, but if you look at the number of bits, they stop at 20. Of course, the obvious question is, does it go on much further? Because of course, solving NP-complete problems with 20 bits is not a big problem. So we would like this to remain a polynomial for very large n. Now, in different papers, people could go higher and higher by using different techniques. For example, Banyu et al., they used the matrix product state. They could go around 60 bits, I think. And in this very recent paper, Young et al., they used quantum Monte Carlo techniques to evaluate the gap, and they could go up to about 100 bits. And in all these cases, actually, the growth was still polynomial. But actually, we had a personal communication with Peter Young, and he told us that they could improve their technique, and they could go up to 200, and at 200, they start to see something which seems to start to be exponential. So apparently, they see something, and it's probably related to what I'm going to describe now. So no, but if we forget about this personal communication, it looks like all the numerical simulations were very promising.
This is polynomial. If I take my head as an experiment list, I'm sure I can put a straight line, and I can put an exponential, which is there.
I know.
Can you put it? Have you tried to put an exponential and say what would be the difference?
I think that for 20 bits, you can do whatever you want. But when you go to 100, then you can just plot a log-log and see if it's a straight line or not. And basically, it looks like a straight line. So, but still, I mean, doesn't mean that it continues for large problems. Actually, some classical heuristics give also a polynomial growth for n less than maybe a few hundred. So it's, of course, it's.
So now these were the good news. Now the bad news is that in some cases the gap can become exponentially small. So one example is when you make a bad choice for your initial Hamiltonian. So there was an example by Znidarek and Horvat, and later it was explained and generalized by once again the MIT group. And also for some specifically designed hard instances of FreeSat or exact cover or NP-complete problems, then the gap can become exponentially small. But the thing is that the gap is exponentially small for specifically designed hard instances. It's not a big deal because usually when you build these hard instances, they have a lot of structure and actually they are easy to solve classically with another algorithm. So it's not a big deal. The problem is when typically the gap is exponentially small. So it's a matter of worst case versus average case complexity. And maybe typically, if you take a random problem, maybe the gap will be very large, and then it's OK. So maybe the typical gap is exponential, and that is only polynomial. And that's what we're going to study. We're going to study random instances and try to see if the gap is typically large or small. So what problem are we considering? We are considering a problem called exact cover. And actually, the only reason why we consider this problem is because this was the one used in numerical simulation that I showed you here and in other numerical simulations. So that's just to compare, to be fair. But we could choose three sets, and it would basically be the same. So how does an exact cover instance look like? So you have n bits. And then you have m closes, and each close has 3 bits. So it's very similar to FreeSat. The only difference is the structure of the closes. So a close with 3 bits is satisfied if the sum of the bits is 1. Or in other words, if one of the 3 bits is 1 and the other two is 0. Okay, so this is an NP-complete problem. And by the way, as opposed to FreeSat, the bits are never negated. So they are always positive. Okay. So the problem, of course, is to find an assignment X satisfying all clauses. And now how can we relate this to my general procedure for adiabatic quantum optimization? Well, we can just say that we want to minimize some function. And the function is a sum over all clauses, which is of term which are zero if the clause is satisfied and non-zero if the clause is violated. So basically, I just want to minimize this function. And this would solve the problem. And what is interesting is that this is only a quadratic function, so I can just expand this, and I get this very simple expression, where m is the number of clauses, B is the number of clauses where the bit I is involved, and jij is the number of clauses where bits I and j are involved. And thanks to this very nice structure, it will be easy to implement it on a quantum computer, if you have one. So now I told you that we were interested in random instances. So in random instances, so we pick a very standard distribution, which is the same. We pick the m clauses uniformly at random. So we pick 3 bits uniformly at random, and then 3 other bits uniformly at random, and we repeat this m times. And this gives you a random instance of exact cover, or the same procedure for free sample. And what is well known is that the hardness of these random instances depends a lot on this clauses to bit ratio. So m is, remember, m is the number of clauses, and n is the number of bits. And if we look at the hardness of this problem as a function of this number of bits, we see that when this ratio is very low, there are not a lot of clauses, so the problem is always satisfiable. So this is the probability that there is a solution when you pick a random instance. So basically, it's always 1, and then at some point, it will drop to 0, because you have too many clauses and too many constraints, and then you don't have any solution anymore. What is interesting is that actually there's another so-called phase transition, which I call the clustering threshold. Because when you have very few clauses, basically you have a very high density of solutions. Basically, almost any assignment is a solution. But then at some point, when you increase the number of clauses further, you will only have very small, smaller and smaller isolated clusters of solutions, small islands of solutions, which are very farther and farther from each other as you add clauses. And if you add more clauses, at some point, all these clusters will disappear, and we will not have any solution anymore. So of course, you can understand that the problem is very easy here and here. Because here, basically, anything is a solution, so it's very easy to find. And here, with high probability, there's no solution. So you can just say there's no solution, and with high probability, you will be right. So in this region, actually, the problem is already hard. But of course, it's very close to here, where there are very few solutions that you find the hardest problem. And this is the region we will be interested in. And why are we considering this region? Well, because it's the region for which we cannot solve the problem on a classical computer. So of course, it's not interesting to solve a problem on a quantum computer if you can solve it also on a classical computer. And that's why this model of random instances is interesting. Because actually, if you look at instances of NP-complete problems, or FreeSat, or exact cover, or whatever, that you get from practical problems, usually these problems have a lot of structure. And thanks to this structure, actually, you can solve them for much higher number of bits. Classical solvers can solve FreeSat instances for up to 1 million of bits, and it's not a problem. Because these instances usually have a lot of structure. So that's why we are interested in random instances, because random instances don't have any structure. And these are the ones you cannot solve on a classical computer. So unless you assume that you can build a quantum computer with more than a million qubits, you will not beat classical solvers for practical instances. But for random instances, you can beat them, because for random instances, classical solvers can only deal with maybe a few thousand bits, but not much more. And there maybe there's a hope that quantum computers can do better. Okay? So we will be interested in this region very close to the satisfiability threshold. So now that I explained you the problem, let's give you the algorithm, which is a standard algorithm proposed by the MIT group and used in all these numerical simulations, for example. So we use as a problem Hamiltonian, a problem where each bit assignment has some energy. And thanks to this, the structure of this function as a quadratic function, you can write it as a sum over sigma z and with two local terms. Okay, which is something that is reasonably hopeful that you can do on a quantum computer. So this is for the problem Hamiltonian. For the initial Hamiltonian, so we have to choose a Hamiltonian for which we know the ground state, and also this Hamiltonian doesn't have to commute with this one, otherwise there's nothing quantum in it. So a standard choice is just to use a sum of sigma x, so it's a transverse field for all the bits. And so you can write also in this basis, it's just basically all states are coupled if they are at distance, Hamming distance 1 from each other. Okay. And the ground state of this Hamiltonian is just the uniform superposition of all bit strings. it's all bits pointing in the x direction. Okay? And now the quantum algorithm, of course, is just to prepare this state, switch, apply Hamiltonian H0, and then switch to HP, then use a linear function, and then with T large enough so that you don't have any excitation.
Hamiltonian according to the choice of the alpha, or the ratio of the M over N.
What
you just mentioned that you are interested in the very hard instances. Or do you somehow, do you fix alpha?
Yeah, alpha is fixed. We fix alpha very close to the satisfied bit threshold, because that's where
according to this choice of the alpha, do you have some constraint among the distribution on the J and the B?
No, alpha just fixes the number of terms, the typical scaling of BI and J and J. That's the only thing.
Okay.
Because when you have more clauses, then this thing can get higher. Because this is, remember, BI is the number of clauses where bit I appears, and J and J is the number of bits where number of clauses where bits I and J appear together.
Okay.
So you can easily find the distribution of BI and JIJ for fixed alpha. The only thing is with higher alpha, BI and JIJ will be on average larger. That's the only thing that changes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So do we know what is alpha, the function of n, or the function of n? So if I give you, I tell you a million qubit, what is the value of alpha when you get this?
Well, actually, I don't think that there's a. I don't know if for exact algorithm there's a rigorous proof, but it's conjectured to be constant. That's the thing. Alpha is conjectured to be constant,
right,
for large n. So when you look at this this thing, just this drops of course faster and faster, but alpha stays the same. So
now I can explain you what is the connection with Anderson localization, which was in the title of the talk. What we want to show is that this Hamiltonian has very small gap, very close to the end of the evolution, so very close to S equals to 1. And we want to show this by perturbation theory around S equals to 1. So to do that, instead of looking at H of S, we look at H of S over S. And then the Hamiltonian can be written like this, just the problem Hamiltonian plus lambda, the initial Hamiltonian. Well, lambda now can be used as a perturbation parameter. And we look at this, well, lambda is just 1 minus s over s. And since we're interested in s equals to 1, we'll be interested in lambda close to 0. Okay, so we can use perturbation theory in lambda. Now, the thing is that this Hamiltonian can be written in this way, where you see that each bit string has a different energy. And since you have random instances, these will be random energies with some distribution. And then you have some coupling between the nearest neighbors on the hypercube. And the point is that this Hamiltonian is exactly the same. Well, you can understand this as a particle hopping on a hypercube. So each x gives you some position on the hypercube. So each position has some energy given by this. And then you have some coupling given, some amplitude of hopping between different positions given by this term. And the point is that this form of Hamiltonian is exactly the same Hamiltonian used by Anderson in his Anderson localization theory. So it's the so-called tight binding model. So let's say something about the Anderson localization. But Anderson localization, Peter Anderson received the Nobel Prize in Physics, in particular about for his work on Anderson localization. And what he showed is that when you have a medium with some disorder, extended states, essentially what it says that extended states can become localized due to disorder. So what does that mean? So his model is exactly the same as we have, but instead of having a hypercube, he has a grid. Think, for example, a 3D grid. You have some medium, some solid, and you have particles, say atoms in different positions in this grid. And then you have some electron which can hop between these different atoms. And his model is that since there are impurities in your medium, the energy of the electron for different sites is random, because there is some random impurities which could appear anywhere. So you have random energies for the different sites, and then you have some probability, some amplitude of hopping between different sites. And this is a model used for metal insulator transitions. Because when the probability, the amplitude of hopping is very large, you can just ignore the random energies. And because the coupling is stronger. And then basically your state, the eigenstates of your Hamiltonian are just waves on this medium. So basically the electron can move. And since it has, so the eigenstates have overlap everywhere on your medium, the states are called extended. So this is metal behavior. But then when the energies become much stronger, when the disorder is too strong, this totally breaks the behavior. And at some point, the electron will become bound to one of the atoms and cannot move anymore. And this means that its amplitude is very large on one atom, and then its amplitude decreases on the neighbor as a function of the distance. So the state becomes localized, and this is insulator behavior. So of course, this is a very important theory, which has very nice applications. And what we show here is that this has application to adiabatic quantum computing also. Because as I just told you in the previous slide, we have exactly the same Hamiltonian. The only difference is that now we don't have a grid, we have a hypercube. And the energies now are also random, and they come from exact cover three. Okay? So now we have a particle hopping on the side of a hypercube, and we would have the same effect. When lambda, with the probability of hopping, is very large, it means when the initial Hamiltonian is stronger, the states are just diagonal in the sigma x basis, basically. And so it means that in a sigma z basis, they are extended. But then when lambda becomes very small, they become localized in the sigma z basis. Well, actually, I have a picture here. So, so start with lambda equals zero. So when lambda equals zero, you just have the final Hamiltonian, which is diagonal in the sigma z basis. So basically, all the qubits will be up or down, and your eigenstate is just localized. And if everything goes well, you are in the ground state. But then when you add this transverse field, the transverse field will spread the state. All the qubits will start rotating a little bit in the sigma x direction. And this means that the state will become larger and become larger and larger, and will get more and more amplitude on its neighbors. And when lambda is very large, then the state is extended. Basically, there is amplitude everywhere. Okay, so there's a clear analogy with what was described with in Anderson localization theory. So, but how can we use this theory to prove anything about adiabatic quantum computing? Well, if you think about it, one problem that could happen in adiabatic quantum optimization is when a local minimum becomes later the global minimum. Oh, by the way, sorry. Of course, the algorithm goes in the reverse direction. You start with lambda very large, so you start with the state extended, and then progressively you become localized, and then you become localized in the, hopefully in the ground state. So why how does quantum mechanics help in this problem? Quantum mechanics helps by tunneling. Suppose you have some local minimum, which later becomes the global minimum. And suppose that this happens when states are still extended. So when you look at this, it seems that you have a level crossing here. But actually, you never have level crossing. Crossings are always avoided, because unless you have a very strong symmetry, which doesn't happen which will happen with probability zero, essentially, so you never have level crossing. So it looks like you have a level crossing. But what actually happens is that if this happens when the state is still extended, like it has amplitude almost everywhere, you see that there's a significant amplitude on the other place. And intuitively, what would happen is that there will be no problem. The particle will just tunnel from one side to the other. Okay? And what happens actually when you look at the spectrum is that the gap, the crossing here becomes avoided. But since this tunneling amplitude is very large, there's a large anti-crossing gap. And which means that the gap will be very large, and which means that there's tunneling. So you can follow the ground state. So there's no problem as long as the states are extended. But now what happens if this kind of level crossing happens when the state is already localized, then you will have a problem. Because the state is localized. And by definition, a localized state means that the amplitude decreases exponentially in the distance. So suppose that these two wells are separated by a distance of order n. Then there's an exponentially small amplitude in the other place here. And if you go too fast, the particle will not have any time to tunnel to the other, to the final ground state. So what happens is that if this happens, if this crossing happens when the state is already localized, then there's a very small, so there's always an intercrossing gap. There's always an avoided crossing. Levels never actually cross. But then this avoided crossing will be very small. And this means that there will be a Landau-Zeno transition. You will not follow the ground state, and you will just jump to the first excited state. And you will end up in this state instead of this one. So we see that there's an issue as soon as there are level crossings in the localized region. So basically, our result can be summarized as follows. If level crossing appears when states are extended, no problem. But in this region where states are localized, there cannot be any level crossing, because otherwise the algorithm will fail. And what we show is, as the size of the problem n increases, by analogy to Anderson localization, we show that this implies that the position of the extended to localized transition is for some lambda which scales as 1 over log n. Okay, and actually we have very well good reason to believe that actually this is of order 1, but we can discuss about this later. And the second thing is that what I will show now is that level crossing appears for smaller and smaller lambda. And this smaller and smaller lambda decrease as n to the minus 1 over 8. So of course this decreases much faster than this. So at some point level crossing will appear in this region. So for n large enough, you will have level crossing in the forbidden region, and then the algorithm will fail.
And what we argue is that
the reason why it seemed like the scaling of the gap was polynomial for large n, for small n, was because this n was not large enough. It was not large enough to have level crossing in this region. Okay? So we can actually estimate the scaling of the position of the level crossing. And this is what we did. So this we can obtain analytically, but we can obtain the constant by numerical simulation. So first, let's explain how we can show that level crossing will appear for a lambda scaling like this. So suppose you start with an instance of a random instance of exact cover with two solutions, or at least two solutions, but you just focus on two of them. Then they both have energy zero for lambda equals zero, because they are both solutions of the problem. But the thing is that when lambda is different from zero, they will split, because you never have degeneracies for lambda different from zero. So they will split. And for lambda large enough, at some point, the difference will become of order 1. See, here it's larger than 4 for sufficiently large lambda. And now, add another clause to your problem. So suppose that this is the situation before you add the last clause. So you pick m minus 1 random clauses. You still have two solutions. And then you add the last clause. And this last clause is such that it is satisfied by one of them and violated by the other one. If it's satisfied by E1, but violated by E2, it means that E2 will go up, because now there's an additional penalty for this one, because it's violated by the additional clause. Anyway, stop me if it's not clear. This is the basic idea how a level crossing appears. So this means that this level goes up, and here, for example, by the way, when you add one clause, remember how the function we're minimizing looks like. For each clause, there is a term which can be either 0, 1, or 4. 0 if the clause is satisfied, 1 or 4 if the clause is violated. So this means that by adding one clause, you can never increase the energy of a level by more than 4. So suppose that you increase it by 4. But remember that I assume that the splitting was large enough so that at lambda star, this was more than 4. So since this can increase at most 4, and this is more than 4, it means that obviously the level has to cross somewhere. Okay? So you have a level crossing.
Add these two classical assignments, 1 and 2, to the 1 and 2 when you add some x field. So I would imagine that basically for very small fields like the plus and the minus,
this is the solutions.
are the two eigenstates. So
yes.
It's completely impossible to say that the one or the other one is the one which is...
That's right. Actually, what happens here is that the state is degenerate. So actually, it's a kind of level crossing. Instead that you don't see the end of the level crossing. But there's a level crossing appearing here. So on the level crossing, the eigenstates, there's a splitting of the two eigenstates, and the sum and the difference of the two eigenstates become an eigenstate. But that, when you go further, these states are localized in one of the two wells, actually. So when this degeneracy is raised, here you can really associate it, because if you look at the eigenstate corresponding to this one and this one, they will be localized in two different around two different vertices of your Hubble cube. Okay. And it's only when you get closer that then the sum and the difference will become the eigenstate. So the closer you get, of course, the more you will get in the situation where you get superposition. But when this distance is of order 1, then you can really have two localized eigenstates. And there will not be any superposition. You can really associate them.
You can see this by perturbation theory, actually, because you can look at this by perturbation theory around one and around the other.
Okay. And by the way, of course, when you raise this degeneracy here, there's no problem anymore. Mm-hmm. As you can understand. So, and you can really, you're adding just one clause, so you can really compare the states here and here almost don't change, actually. It's only close to the crossing here that you have this effect of superposition of the two states. But actually, the eigenstates here and here are almost the same because you have a large number of clauses and you only change one of them, so it almost does not change the eigenstates, except close to a level crossing. Okay. So you have a level crossing here, but as I told you, there's never such thing as a level crossing. You always have avoided crossing, anti-crossing. So what happens is that if these two assignments here are at distance n from each other, if you look at
if you compute this gap by perturbation theory, you will see that it's only resolved at order n in perturbation theory, which means that the gap will scale as lambda to the n. And remember what I told you, that very close to the satisfiability threshold, you have a few solutions far away from each other. So typically, these two solutions will be at distance of order big N from each other, of order of the size of the system, which means that this N scales, this little N scales as a big N, which means that this gap is exponentially small. So we'll show this in more details in further slides. So this is the basic idea of how level crossing appears. And now we can really study, now we want to know how large, what is the splitting between these two states, to know at what distance lambda star there will be a difference of order 4 between the two, because this is the condition for level crossing to appear. Oh yeah, by the way, here I told you that the one level was killed, that the blue level was killed and the red level remained after you had the additional clause. Of course, you can do it in the wrong direction. Maybe if you're not lucky, you would kill the wrong one and there will be no level crossing because the slope is higher for this one than this one. But the thing is, of course, that we just focused on two particular solutions. Typically, we have a few separated solutions. And also, we just look at the effect of adding the last clause. But any other clause, if you remove it, it could create additional solution. So basically, what will happen is you will have other levels. And each of these levels can cross. So with high probability, actually, you will have a level crossing between some two levels. Okay. So now let's study how this splitting looks like, because we are really interested in the splitting between these two levels, how the splitting scales like. And we do it by perturbation theory. So we just write the energy of a level as a Taylor expansion, so this basic perturbation theory. And what we proved is that the all coefficients in perturbation theory, they all scale as n for any order. So this shows that for large n, we can just look at the first one because it will give the lead behavior. For large n and small lambda, the first non-zero correction will give the leading order in your perturbation theory. And the proof is based on the statistical properties of random instances. So this is where really random instances come into place. We need this to prove that this is of order n. And No, the thing is that we are not really interested in one particular energy. We are interested in the difference between two energies, because we want to show that these two energies will split. So we look at the difference between two energies. And the difference, the average will be zero, because you have two random solutions, and they have the same distribution. So these two, the average of these two things will be zero. But then since you have, actually, the way how we prove that you have, this is of order n, we prove that there is of order n terms in this sum. And when we look at this, we have of order n terms, which all have zero mean. But we have of order n terms, which means that actually, on average, the square of this will scale as n. If we just look at this, it will scale as square root of n, because the mean is zero. Okay? So if you take a sum of n random values with mean zero, you will get something which scales as square root of n. Okay? So we get this scaling. and now we can check this by perturbation theory, and also this will give us the exact scaling of this this splitting. So we generated random instances of exact cover 3 with at least two solutions, and then we computed this. We looked at two particular solutions, and then we computed the splitting between the two energies. And we did this at fourth order perturbation theory. Why fourth order? First, because odd orders are zero, so it looks like the first, the leading orders should be order two. But then, by accident, for exact cover three, the order two correction is actually solution independent. So if you want to look at the difference between two energies, you have to go at order four. Actually, for three sets, this would happen at order two, so it's really an accident for exact cover. Actually, maybe I can comment later, but that's one of the reasons why numerical simulations seems better for three set than exact cover, because exact cover, we have to go at higher order. Well, this is an explanation, and actually the MIT group, they told me that one of the reasons they used exact cover and not three set is because the numerical simulations look better for three set than exact cover, therefore exact cover than for three set. And we can explain this now, because we see that the splitting appears at order four only for exact cover and order two at for three set. Anyway, that's just a comment. So we did this for a large number of instances, and then we computed the energy difference by fourth order perturbation theory. And then we really, so these are different statistical properties, like the different percentiles and the mean. And we see that indeed, if you look at the square of this difference, it's really well fitted by the linear scaling. And in the inset, it's actually the sixth order, so we can show that it's also true for the sixth order. So actually, it should be true for any order. That's what we proved analytically. But by doing this, we can get a value, an estimation of this value for C. Okay? So this means that the splitting between E1 and E2 becomes larger and larger as n increases, which means that at some point, this splitting will be larger than 1 or larger than 4 for a very small lambda. And at some point, this lambda would be small enough to be in the localized region, which would cause exponentially small gaps. So essentially, when we show that this splitting will be with high probability larger than 4 for lambda, which scales less like n to the minus 1 over 8. So this is where the lambda n to the minus 1 over 8 scales like. So this shows that for lambda larger than this, perturbation theory predicts level crossings. For the other condition is that the perturbation theory is valid. And that's where Anderson localization comes around. So of course, now that we know where the level crossing appears, we can estimate what the gap is for this particular lambda. And once again, by using perturbation theory, we can give a rigorous upper bound on the gap if a level crossing appears between two solutions at some particular lambda star. And the gap just is as this, where n is the distance between the two solutions. And the way we prove this is by reduction to another problem, which we could call the agree problem, which is a problem where with only two-bit clauses, and each clause is just saying that the two bits should be equal. So of course, this problem has only two solutions, all zero state and all one state. And actually, we can look at the level crossing created between these two solutions, and we show that by reduction, this gives a bound on the level crossing for the exact cover three instance. Okay, so now we know where minimum gaps appears, and we know the scaling of the gap if minimum gap appears somewhere. So we can put the two things together. So we know that level crossing appears for lambda star of this order, and we know that typical distance between solutions is of order n, the number of bits, and we know that the gap is this, as a function of this. So we put everything together, and we show that the gap is exponentially, actually even super exponentially small. Which was actually, this is even worse than classical SAT solvers. Now, of course, there's one trick, is that we have used perturbation theory, okay? Oh, yeah, sorry, first. I show you an actual level crossing that we obtained by numerical simulations. So this is a simulation of an anti-crossing by fourth order perturbation theory. This is for 200 bits, and the distance between the two solutions here is 60 bits. So this shows that even you see a level crossing here, perturbation theory predicts a level crossing, and you have to go at order 60 in perturbation theory to resolve the crossing here and to get an anti-crossing, an avoided crossing. So once again, we use perturbation theory. But now, how can we trust perturbation theory? That's the problem. And the thing is that this is the subject of Anderson localization. And Anderson localization tells you that perturbation theory is valid as long as states are localized. Because when states are localized, they are very close to the eigenstate at the end of the evolution. So this means that you can find the states by perturbation around the localized state at the end. So now we can make an analogy with a case where Anderson localization is fully solved. The trick is actually that Anderson localization is really a non-trivial problem. It's a highly complex problem. And it's only fully understood on the Cayley tree. So even on the grid, I think anybody believes that it's correct. I mean, it's used successfully in many applications, but there's mathematically speaking, it's a very hard problem, and it's not fully understood even on the grid. So the only case where it's fully solved is on the so-called Cayley tree, which is just a constant fan-out tree. So here, k equals 2, for example. And in this case, we can show that the transition from localized to extended happens for this particular lambda. So in this case, you really have it's once again exactly the same Hamiltonian. You have random energies for each side, and then coupling lambda between the neighbors. And the critical lambda is given by E, where E is the standard deviations of the energies. So it gives you the scaling of the disorder. So when the disorder is higher, states are more localized. And K gives you K is just the degree of the graph. Not exactly degree, but the fan out. So here K equals 2. So this is known analytically. And so this is where we make an assumption. We make an assumption that we can reduce all Ks to the case of the Cayley tree. And we have arguments why we can do that. Basically, the reason why Anderson localization is fully understood on the Cayley tree is because there are no loops. Yet, when you go from one side to the other, you never have any loops. And so you can solve everything recursively. But actually what happens is that in our case, we're only interested in localized state. We don't care about extended state. We don't have to prove that extended state even exists. You just have to have a bound on lambda c. And the thing is that loops can only make localization stronger. So it goes in the right direction for us. So ignoring loops should give us a bound. And so if we assume that this analogy is correct, and this is something we should work out, then in our case, the energy, the standard deviations of the energies are of order n, because it's basically the number of clauses, which gives us n for fixed clauses to bits ratio. So the random energy scales as n. And the degree of the graph also scales as n. So if you plug this here, we get that the gap scales as 1 over log n. And of course, 1 over log n decreases much slower than 1 over n to the minus 1 over 8, which is the only thing we need. We need that at some point, this will become smaller than this. Because at this point, this is the typical location of level crossing. And this is the lambda for which perturbation theory is still valid. So at some point, the level crossing predicted by perturbation theory will be in the region where perturbation theory is valid. And so this works. So actually, so we have 1 over log n by reduction to this. But actually, we have a very good reason to believe that actually this should be of order 1 in our case. And the reason is that since all corrections in the perturbation theory are all of order n, we can just, so in a sense, this lambda c is a sort of convergence radius of perturbation theory. It's not exactly correct, and if you're interested, we can talk about this, but because perturbation theory actually always diverges. So we have an asymptotic series and not a convergence series, but still, we can still use it up to this lambda c. So if if all these corrections in this Taylor expansion of order n, we can just factor it out, and we should have something which is n independent, which means that this kind of convergence radius should be constant. So this is already the end of my talk. So what we show is that under some localization causes exponentially small gaps in adiabatic quantum optimization. And one thing, I told you that we studied exact cover, but for any similar NP-complete problems, which is a 3-sat or K-sat, or we would get exactly the same effect. You see, as I told you, for 3-sat, it would be even worse because the level crossing would appear faster because there is this, because the splitting appears already at order 2 and not order 4. So, but still, the overall scaling would be the same. And another thing is that it does not depend on the particular path of H of S. Actually, since we only concluding this from perturbation theory around S equals to 1, it means that it only matters what you're doing very close to S equals to 1, so in which direction you arrive at the final Hamiltonian. And as long as this is local, which should be a natural assumption for a quantum computer, we will get exactly the same conclusion. So as long as the perturbation around S equals to 1 is a local Hamiltonian, we will get exactly the same conclusion. So of course, there is this important assumption, is that localization on the hypercube is correct, that we can use localization on the hypercube, and this is something that should be studied more closely. But we have a very good argument why this should be the case. And that's it, thank you.
So, okay, so on this last point, that's the only thing that you need to prove so that this whole thing is a complete rigorous proof?
Yes.
And so when you said something about an asymptotic series.
Yes.
I mean, there's other reasons for debate.
It's exactly the problem about proving that Anderson localization is correct. Because I don't know if you know a little bit about Anderson localization, and I can tell you that like 1 year ago, I didn't know anything. Hopefully we have a specialist on this, and that's why I trust him that he's convinced that there's no problem. But of course, we would like to prove it. So what happens is that perturbation theory diverges. Actually, as soon as you have an anti-crossing somewhere, perturbation theory has to diverge, because at some point, you will have a singularity close to level crossing. So it looks like you cannot use perturbation theory close to level crossing. But the thing is that actually, you can still use perturbation theory even further than the level crossing. Because it's not because perturbation theory diverges that it cannot be useful. Actually, what happens is that if you look at successive orders in perturbation theory, and you look at how far is your estimation by perturbation theory compared to the actual value of your energy. So if you plot as a function of k, basically the error you get on the energy, well, it should be like E perturbation theory of k minus the exact energy. Okay, if you look at this, at first few order, actually this error decreases. So you can use it and get better and better and better approximation on the exact eigenvalue. But then at some point, it will start increasing again. And the point is that this is exactly the distance between the where the first level crossing is. In this case, as n. So this means that as long as you stop before, it's okay. Well, this is actually all right. So the trick that was used by Anderson to prove that something is convergent is that he added a very small imaginary part to all his energies, and this makes actually this series convergent. And then he first took the limit n goes to infinity, and then he took the limit of this small imaginary part to the energy goes to zero. And by doing this, he can keep everything convergent, and that's how you can give rigorous proof of Anderson localization. So it's highly non-trivial thing, but basically it works.
to give you an idea maybe why you can use perturbation theory up to of order n, when you have suppose you have a level crossing between two states which are very far apart. Because it should be hypercube, but suppose it's just a grid and you have a level crossing between this one and this one. When you make perturbation theory, the first order will only have overlap here, second order only overlap here. So, and same for this thing. So this means that if you go at first few order, you will not see the level crossing. And essentially, these two states will live in completely decoupled eigenstate spaces. So this means that you can still use perturbation theory because the coupling between these two states only appears at very high order, which is basically the order of the distance between the two. So that's why you can use perturbation theory for first higher for low orders, and you can get better and better approximation. So this is the intuition. But this is something which is highly non-trivial, and this is why actually even for the grid, for the original model of Anderson localization, it's not completely solved, apparently. But the only place where it's completely solved is the KD tree. But there's people have a lot of arguments and estimations and why it should be correct. And by numerical simulations, it seems like it works, but there's no mathematical proof. The thing is that what we need in our case is weaker than what people try to prove for the grid or for this other system. So there's a hope that we actually can give a rigorous proof in this case. Because we only have to prove that there is localization, and we don't need the exact position of the threshold. We don't even need to prove that the threshold scales as something. We just need a bound on the threshold, which is finite. Actually, for example, another thing is that I told you that by analogy to the KD tree, you would get 1 over log n and not over order 1 for this lambda where perturbation theory fails. But the thing is that this 1 over log n comes from the fact that you want all states to be localized in the whole energy spectrum. And in our case, we are only interested in the very low energies. And for this case, we think that over order 1 is necessary, for example. So actually, all the differences that we can find between what we did and what is known always goes in the right direction for us. So that's why we think that we can be optimistic that it will work.
Correlation between initial Hamiltonian and the final target Hamiltonian, right? Do you think that we have the basically same problem regardless of the choice of this?
Yes, because since we prove that these small gaps appear by using perturbation theory very close to S equals to 1, it means that you don't care about what's happening in the beginning. It's only what happens at the very end which matters. Only the perturbation around S equals to 1. Right. So of course then you have different choices. But the thing is that our argument shows that as long as this choice is a local Hamiltonian, it will only couple neighbors on the hypercube. And for this reason, the whole argument will still hold.
I see.
And the thing is that when you change this, you could have level, maybe it's for some choice of perturbation, for some choice of initial Hamiltonian, say, you will have some level crossing with some between two solutions. And then you can solve this by using another choice of initial Hamiltonian. The thing is that since you have many levels for the very low energy bands, you have a lot of levels. You will never solve all the crossings with priority 1. I mean, with priority approaching 1 as n increases, you will always have a crossing with at least two levels. So you can solve some level crossings, but by solving them, you will introduce other ones. There's no hope that it works because in a very low energy band, there's a large number of levels. So. Yeah.
So this essentially shows that adiabatic quantum computing will be never useful to solve this complete problems, and therefore P is not equal to P.
Because we are looking at one particular algorithm. Well, actually one particular class of algorithms, which is using as final Hamiltonian this particular Hamiltonian. This could be something else. For example, for the proof of universality of adiabatic quantum computing, it doesn't have this flavor. The final Hamiltonian is a Hamiltonian whose ground state is actually the history state, so the superposition of all history in your quantum circuit. So it really doesn't look like this one. So you can find something more involved which uses adiabatic
quantum computation, but which does not fit into this model.
Is there any question? Otherwise, let's thank speaker once again. We stay until tomorrow, right?
Yeah, I'm leaving tomorrow morning, unfortunately.
Okay, but still we have the pub night here.
Yeah,
so.
The thing is that Rolando invited me, and then after he invited me, he told me he was leaving, so I came earlier to meet him before he leaves, and then to leave earlier.
Yeah, but still the, you got some overlap. Right?
Yeah, that's what we did. That's why I had to leave tomorrow already, because I couldn't be away for too long. So. Or the NEC allows you to leave for weeks.
Yeah, thank you very much.